We made this.
Everybody to the X-Cast. As ever, the truth is in here. I am your host, Carl Sweeney, and welcome to this episode of the X-Cast, which is discussing the first episode of Season 7, The Sixth Extinction. Really good to be back for Season 7, and I'm joined by my fellow co-showrunners, Kurt North and Sarah Blair. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Who are you going to call?
It's so good to be back with you.
X-Casters!
It is good to be back. Season 7, it we're is. Here.
You guys, I think I watched the wrong episode. Just kidding. Yeah. I mean, I watched it. I think I took notes on the wrong episode. It's fine.
It wasn't the one with Skinner in the bubble bath, was it, Sarah, that you watched?
No. No. That one's coming, though.
That's coming later this season. Yeah, lots of good stuff coming this season. How have you guys spent the podcasting hiatus? What have you been up to? Kurt, what have you been up to? Sunbathing, you know, just chilling out.
Preparing for the grand reopening of the world, basically. Yeah. That's the best way of describing it. Been really busy at work. Done a few podcasts here and there, Shipwrecked and Comatose. I've done a few recordings, but podcasting itself has been really, really quiet, purposely, because I've had a lot going on in personal and official life and professional life. So not too much. Have been kind of just doing the tail off stuff with Millennium on The Time Is Now as well, just kind of wrapping that up. So we've done the majority of that now, and there'll be some specials on the way. But mainly just like, you know, doing 20 odd thousand steps a day at work. So that's what I've been concentrating on. Yeah.
That's good. I reckon 10,000 a day is what you should aim for, don't they? So you're doing yours and mine together.
I wish I could aim for 10,000 steps. That would help. Yeah.
Sarah, how about you? How's it going? How's life across the pond?
Oh, it's going. It's going. I've been working on my book, so I've got book brain, and nothing is functioning except my words. I'm just putting all my energy into making so many words. I'm about to hit 60,000 on my rewrite, so it's a lot of words. My scrap file, I think, has over 200,000 words.
Blimey.
So it's a lot.
Mm-hmm. By the time this episode goes out, I think the book will be finished.
Maybe. It won't be out, but maybe.
No.
Maybe it'll be finished. We'll see.
It won't be out. The grand reopening, Kurt, referred to of the UK, may or may not have taken place fully by the time this episode goes out. It's looking increasingly dubious as we record.
Yeah. Uncertain world. These uncertain times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, getting back to something. We're building a new normal, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
Anyway, how are you guys feeling about the prospect of podcasting about Season 7, which is what we're kicking off here? Excited?
Very.
Interested. Yeah. Interested, I think, is the word for me.
Let's break that down. Hang on. Excited, Sarah, because why?
Well, spoiler alert, I already recorded the Goldberg variation with Cortland yesterday. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. So I think I'm looking forward to Season 7. I like it. I like Season 7 a lot. And I think Season 6 definitely holds a special place in my heart because it's got a lot of episodes that I rewatch constantly. But Season 7 has some really fun episodes in it. So, you know, I'm here for that.
Yeah. And Kurt, you're interested, and that has a different connotation, I think.
It has a slightly different connotation. It's one of the seasons I least like. My least favourite, I'll say, because I don't ever dislike a season of The X-Files, to be fair. I don't think any season's bad. But Season 7, for some reason, doesn't really have anything to grip on with for me. There's some great episodes. There is some fantastic episodes. Behind the scenes, I've already recorded the Millennium episode. That's not a great episode, but you'll listen to that as you get on. And that's more to do with Millennium than anything else. Yeah. There's some marvelous stuff in this season. You know, things like X-Cops and Closure and Zion, which are particular favourites of mine. But then it just, I struggle every time I think of season 7 to think about the season as a whole and what episodes are contained within it. And I know that you're a big fan, Carl, of Chimera, and I have watched that, rewatched that, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years, and I do have a slightly better reappreciation of it. And that's why I'm interested, because I think that when we go into the season, there'll be episodes I'll reappraise more, and take them for what they are. I think that season 7 for me is a season. I talked about, you know, like season 6 being the greatest hits, you know, just single after single after single. I think this for me is more like a fourth album where there's 5 or 6 good songs on it, and I'll just listen to them and never listen to the others. And that's probably the way I'll leave it. So it feels to me that I don't watch season 7 enough. And yeah. I think the other side of it is that the either side, you've got season 6, which I think is a wonderful season, and season 8, which is a particular favourite season of mine. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting one.
I like season 7, and I like it more than I used to. It's going to be interesting, I think, for us to follow up our coverage of season 6, because, and I think this maybe is what you're saying, Kurt, I don't think season 7 necessarily hangs together as well as a season as season 6 does. And I think it definitely hits lower lows. Like, I think there's a couple of episodes this season that are definitely amongst the worst the series ever did.
You think?
Definitely think so. Sarah might disagree on one of those. We might discover this as the season goes on. However, I think I might actually prefer season 7 to season 6 in some ways, because there's quite a few episodes here which I wouldn't say they're exactly top-tier X-Files, but I think they're solid outings, and I think they're in my kind of wheelhouse, up my alley, you know? I'm thinking things like Rush, Signs and Wonders, Thief, Chimera. They're just good, solid meat and potatoes episodes, you know? And it's interesting as well with the mythology, Kurt, isn't it? Because it's much looser, and like we'll probably talk about that on this episode, and we'll talk about this trilogy a bit more. But I love like Sailor's Light and Closure. I love Requiem. I think Honor Me has got a lot going for it, actually. So there's that, and I think there's just other episodes I really enjoy too. There's like things like X-Cops and Jesuette, which are really fun. So I think we'll have a blast on the X-Cast this year. Do you understand what I mean about mythology, though?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, we'll touch upon it. I think that even by reappraising these two episodes, you know, coming up, that I've started to enjoy them more than I used to, which is good. But yeah, it's a fresh start. It's a false start in a lot of ways, and, you know, it does get continued on later in the show's run. But, yeah, there's a lot here that could be mined and could have been done better moving forward. It's just the same, it kind of stalls after this season, really. But there's a lot of good concepts, I think, in this season for that.
Okay, so like I said at the outset, we're here to discuss The Sixth Extinction, which is the first episode of the season, not the first episode filmed, but the first episode broadcast, of course. It follows on from Biogenesis. This episode was first shown on the 7th of November, 1999. It was written by Chris Carter and directed by Kim Manners. So, Sarah, I don't know if we should just bring you up to speed, first of all, because Kurt and I talked about Biogenesis with Darren.
Yes, please.
On the podcast.
I have no idea what's going on. Clearly, I really have no idea what's going on since I took notes on Amor Fati, so it's fine. This is Mercury is retrograde, and nothing is going to go right, so we just have to expect that. This is an X-File. It's fine. But I did watch the episode.
Okay.
So there's that at least.
Yeah. Well, no, I was going to ask you, because, like I say, Kurt and I have already weighed in on Biogenesis, but just on the third, like the last episode of season 6, the first part of the trilogy, how did you feel watching that yesterday? Like, before we get to this episode we're here to discuss in full. Can you separate them in your mind?
Kind of. Can I just be honest and say, after I watched it, I felt full of dread for the next ones to come, because could it really get worse? I don't know. I don't like these. These are not the ones that I love to rewatch the most.
Why?
And you know, yes. I'm not really a mythology person to begin with.
But this is a new chapter, you know. It's
yeah,
all the other stuff. The syndicate's not there. And, you
know. I feel like the mythology really peaked at Gethsemane and Redux. Those are my favorite like, I mean, you've got like Paperclip and that the Anasazi trilogy, which I really love. That's really good stuff. And then you've got Gethsemane and Redux, and those are so good, and they're just like really solid, powerful episodes. And then these ones just go way off the deep end, and you're like, what is going on? I don't know. This is crazy. And they, like, the aliens supposedly left, but now they're like, crap. They're like, been here for a bajillion years. Like, we knew that from the movie, I guess, that the aliens have been here forever, but I don't know. It's a lot. It's a lot to soak up. And Biogenesis, I mean, you've got the whole thing. Like, is that the one that open, or is this one the one that opens with Scully and she's talking about all the extinctions, and
that's it just goes on. When,
yeah, it goes on forever. And I don't know. I'm trying to think of some really good things to say about it. Scully's hair looks nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am not the person to talk to about mythology stuff because I have no idea what's going on. I don't understand.
I think it's good.
There were some monkeys, and somebody got murdered, and I don't know.
So yeah. Kurt, you know our decision to go ahead and record with Darren with Biogenesis and not Sarah.
It
paid off pretty well, I think.
I think it did. I think
yeah,
it did.
You probably but should. She, just she's saying, me.
Strangely
Sorry,
enough,
guys.
Though, she's saying some things or trying to explain some things that Darren said. Yeah.
How do you mean?
Because the episode itself, the trilogy itself is quite kind of unique pacing. It slows right down. It's different. It's more abstract, more spiritual. You know, it's trying to conjoin two things together. It's a different pacing from what likes a Redux. If you think about Redux, and we'll talk about John Finn shortly, you know, he's doing his JFK impression. Which is like literally, as I said, that it's one of my favorites. I love the circadian rhythm of it. I love the rhythm, of that scene. Whereas this one is very kind of slow paced, you know, we mentioned it in Biogenesis, you know, it's Space Odyssey 2001 aspects to it, you know, there's all that kind of thing. It's a different beast altogether. So the fact it is a mythology, but it's not, it's kind of a quasi new kind of beginning, so it's interesting that way.
I think it's a fair take, Sarah. I think there are a lot of people who probably feel similarly with these episodes. It's very Marmite, isn't it, in some ways, Kurt? I don't know if Sarah knows that expression.
I do.
Okay.
I know, yes, and that is the best way to describe it. That is how I feel. Although I don't mind Marmite. I don't mind it. I, you know. But this, not my favorite.
Let's put you on the spot then, Sarah. So the Sixth Extinction, the one you were supposed to make notes on, just some general thoughts and a mark out of 10. How bad are you saying these episodes are then from your perspective? Are you saying, put a number on it for us?
Well, as far as rewatchable, it's like a 1 because I don't ever watch it if I can help it. Like if I watch it, I'll watch it for the podcast. Or so if I'm doing a rewatch, it would just be, you know, on in the background and not paying attention to it. But as far as critically, I don't know, maybe like a 4 or 5, I guess. Well, it's better than, I did not enjoy Amor Fati at all. I liked this one. If I had to choose between the two, I would choose this one.
So
there's that at least. But I don't have, it's hard for me to find patience for the ridiculousness of like taking it all and just twisting it and just throwing all of the mythology that they built up before that was so good and so intriguing, and then they, you know, just threw it out in the middle of season 6 and were like, hey, let's like have all this biblical stuff and be all wild and supernatural with it. I mean, it is the X-Files, I get it, but
it was touched upon in the end, though. You know, Gibson Praise was touched upon, so it's not new. There's stuff that's already been implanted in there.
Well, yeah, but I don't know. I just have my headcanon, and I feel like they could have done so much after Redux that there's so many choices.
Well, I think we all know what you thought of what happened after Redux, but...
Yeah. So, anyways, it's fine. It's just... This is just me personally. I'm sure that I know lots of people really love the mythology and all that, and that is awesome for them.
I always raise an eyebrow when you talk about your rewatchability score, Sarah. Like, no, I do, because I think... Would you say, like, Schindler's List is really rewatchable? You
know? No, not at all.
But that doesn't mean it's not good.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's a great, great movie that I have seen one time and never again. So, yeah, it's...
I know what you mean.
You know.
I do know what you mean.
Yeah.
So, Kurt, I think last time on Biogenesis, we were actually not far apart, but I was a 7.7. Darren was a 7.5, wasn't he? I was a 7.75. And you were an 8.0. Yeah. So, what about this one? Would you say it's about on a par with Biogenesis or what?
Yeah, I'm not giving myself much headroom, am I? I actually really like this episode. When we discussed about Biogenesis last season, I did watch all three episodes and went back to Biogenesis and watched that one again. With this watch, all I've done is watch the Six Extinctions, so I've kind of forgotten about Amor Fati. For a particular reason, because it kind of is separate.
That's how he dies.
You should have just told me to forget about that one, because that was a mistake. Sorry to interrupt, Kurt.
It's all right.
She's angry. She's seething.
She is seething. She's watched something she didn't even need to watch. It's even better.
She could have been watching Zero Sum for the thousandth time.
I would probably push this up to an 8.25. I actually really, really enjoyed this episode. I don't think I would have said that. And I think I have the same issue with certain episodes of The X-Files where I watch something as a whole rather than its individual parts. And yes, it's a slower paced episode. It's got some interesting discussions to be had with it, and I'm looking forward to discussing that. Mm-hmm. I like the idea that the roles have been reversed. It's Scully doing the investigating and Mulder's in the hospital, which is a nice little reverse on that. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the craft is ridiculous. I talked about the power of words in last episode, last season, and the whole 24 chromosome genome project, all that kind of thing, the Bible, the Quran. It's interesting. I've reevaluated that a little bit, but it's still a bit, okay then. And what it leads into, that's probably my worst part of it is it's what it leads into, not necessarily right now. I actually enjoy it for the moment, but what it leads into in Providence and Providence or whichever way around it is, that's by the by. But at least it is projecting that way. I just think I could have done more with it.
So I would give this episode a 7. I think it's good, but I think it's the weakest one of the trilogy. And the reason I think that is I don't think it hits. I think Biogenesis and Amor Fati have both hit some inspired heights, I'm afraid, Sarah. And I don't think this quite does in the same way, but it is an unusual episode. It's quite novel in its own right in some ways, I think. It feels kind of like an interim episode in some ways between Biogenesis and between The Sixth Extinction 2. And I think at times it's quite difficult to kind of join the dots between all of them. So in Biogenesis, for instance, Kurt, we had Krycek skulking around in the shadows, but he's absent here until he reemerges in the next episode. Scully's in the Ivory Coast for most of the time here, so there's no follow-up yet on the Albert Hostein stuff, although that will come in the next episode. You know, the zombie stuff is kind of particular to this one, isn't it?
Mm.
So... In fact, on the zombie thing, I think Frank Spotnitz said something about, he compared this episode to a 50s monster movie, because you've got Scully out there dealing with the bug attacks and the boiling sea and, you know, Barnes is going mad with a machete and all that kind of thing. And I actually like that. I think there's kind of a pulpy edge to this episode, which is a bit more prominent than it was in Biogenesis. And I don't think it's really there in Amor Fati, because that episode's a bit more grandiose with its kind of literary conceit, isn't it? So... I'll say straight away, I think Amor Fati is the best of the bunch, though. So it's interesting that you hate it so much, Sarah. We might come back to that. There's a quote from Chris Carter. He says, "I felt that with The Sixth Extinction, I was just playing a supporting role, and that the episode, essentially the middle episode of a three-episode arc, was just a transitional episode to get us to Amor Fati, which is really less about the mythology and more about Mulder's choices in life. So what do you guys make of that? Do you see what he means? Like, it feels like a transition rather than something else.
I do. I think I'm watching it this morning. I kind of felt like it was a bit of a throwback to the beginning, the episode of the beginning. So it feels like it's a one shot episode, really, and as a means to an end to a degree. It does feel self-contained, but I think that's, as you say, on purpose with the whole Amalfi thing, that, you know, it's much more of a personal thing on there. It's not necessarily moving set pieces. I think Biogenesis did that with, as you say, with likes of Krycek, and, you know, there is actually something I never really picked up on. I don't know why on earth I've never picked this up before, but when Mulder's writing Krychkov on the hand, That was obviously a play on the fact you're going to write Krycek.
Yeah.
I didn't, it just for some reason today was like, oh, hang on. They're trying to allude to the fact that it might be Krycek.
Yeah.
It's fairly self-contained. So I think it's more delving into some of the, as you say, some of the more loftier things of like the Red Sea and the apparitions. And I know we'll talk about some of them shortly, but it does feel to me like, it's almost exposition in a weird abstract way of like, this is the very thing, the monolith of 2001, like we mentioned last season. It's the monolith. It's the thing that's got untold power, but you know, and it's kind of like just setting that up ready for something in the future. And Amalfi is more of a personal story. So I can see that definitely.
Does it bug you, Sarah, that, I mean, do you agree? Do you feel like these are all disconnected episodes? You know, they're kind of jagged and uneven, or
I feel like since I did watch them all together, mm-hmm. I feel like they are more of a piece, I guess. But it just, I think Biogenesis starts out the strongest and then it just goes downhill from there to the end. And I think probably out of the three, Biogenesis is the one that I was most invested in watching. Uh-huh. And then it got to the end of that, and then I watched Sixth Extinction, and I was kind of in it until Scully had that thing at the beginning, and it just kept going and going. I was like, I don't need a history lesson.
Do you think you like Biogenesis more because it had some of the old mythology stuff in? It had things like Krycek moving in, doing things in the background.
Yeah, I love
like
Krycek. I'm always happy to see Krycek show up. And I really like Krychkov. I love when he shows up. I like him. So that was cool, but I don't know. To me, Amor Fati just kind of goes way out into the abyss. But can somebody please help me understand what the heck is going on with Mulder and the sounds and like all of that? Because I don't understand, why is he the only one that's being affected by this thing?
Okay, Kurt, take it away.
Okay. Tunguska, when he's in the fence and he gets the black oil, he gets inoculated with a vaccine.
Okay.
And Scully gets inoculated with a vaccine in Fight the Future, but the vaccine in Fight the Future is stronger. Which is why Scully doesn't
get
affected.
It's the Pfizer vaccine, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's the Pfizer. It's not the AstraZeneca. So the fact that he's got the radiation from the rubbing the pencil drawing on the ship is all powerful. It's got, obviously, it's able to affect things. It's affected Mulder, and Mulder's effectively become a true life alien human hybrid without the green goo, basically. That's the basic premise of it. So it's the Tunguska stuff that's kind of the reason why.
I love hearing the X-Files mythology explained out loud.
Lord have mercy. Now I just have like 10 more questions. I don't want to derail everything.
Now I think we can take them one by one as we go along, perhaps. That might be a good way to do it.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think the last thing before we start to break down the episode in more depth is, what do you guys think this might have had on IMDb? Do you want to hazard a guess out of 10? Sarah, you go first.
I'm going to say it's probably somewhere around an 8 or like a 7.9.
Okay.
Historically, mythology episodes have rated high. This is getting to the tail end of the show. Has it still got the power and the premise? I was going to say 8.2. I'm going to push that up to 8.4.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah is closer because it's an 8.0. Sarah wins. That actually puts it equal 10th for season 7 on IMDb with The Sixth Extinction 2 and also with Millennium, which gets an 8. So, middle of the pack. I don't know. Well, yeah, maybe. What do you reckon? 10th of the season?
Maybe. I'd probably rate it higher than that. I'd be in the top third.
Might have it in the top 8, personally.
Yep.
Okay, guys, I think we need to take a closer look at The Sixth Extinction.
Need to or want to?
I think we're contractually obliged to. All right, so we kick off in the Ivory Coast. I think one of the things Darren pointed out, wasn't it, Kurt, in the previous episode was I think each episode begins and ends at the coast, isn't it, in some way, shape, or form, including with Mulder's dream vision in Amor Fati.
Apparently a different coast as well, because they couldn't get the original filming location. So
it's interesting. So did the problems here start immediately for you, Sarah? Because you have like the Scully voice over here where like her thoughts are directed to Mulder and she's talking about the rubbing and everything,
beautiful,
you know.
Beautiful mind.
I came in search of something I did not believe existed, et cetera, et cetera. She's working by lamplight. I do
like that Scully finally gets a voiceover. I mean, how many has Mulder had and like Deep Throat and like all the other dudes? Like Scully finally gets, you know. And I miss the days where she would talk about the cases. That was always fun. That kind of reminded me of that a little bit. But yeah.
Then we have Scully voiceovers in stuff like Memento Mori and
Redux. That's true.
I think it's in Redux as well as Redux 2.
It's been a minute.
Is it Redux 2 or Redux 1 that she does a voiceover?
Yeah, well, she opens with Memento Mori and all that. That's good. But so not finally. But, you know, like, it's been a while since she had one. So
yeah,
welcome back, I guess. I'm trying to find nice things to say. So, like, just let me have this, guys.
Yeah, it's good. You sound incredibly positive. Well, it's an interesting mix, Kurt, isn't it? Because in addition to that, it goes on to be about this like bug attack, you know? And I think some of the stuff in this episode, it's kind of lifted from the Book of Exodus, isn't it, I believe?
Mm.
Yeah.
So you guys have seen Singing in the Rain?
Yes.
All I can think about in the biblical plagues and everything is Moses supposes. And it just like it got on in my head and replayed.
Moses supposes,
like,
arises, but Moses supposes erroneously. That one.
Yes,
yeah. Just for
it's
Kurt's
been
benefit.
Like on repeat. Moses supposes, yeah, and it's just so that didn't help me like this episode anymore.
Okay, so it's all Gene Kelly's fault.
It is.
Well, I was gonna say, Kurt, like, how does this teaser grab you? Because you know she's overcome by the bugs as the teaser ends, although it's not really followed up on that much, but.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things, and I don't know whether to bring it up now, but I will. I don't know whether to bring it up, but I'm going to bring it up. I like it. It's an interesting play. It's interesting that we've got a year out of Millennium, and we've got the piano kind of feel vibes, like Goodbye to All That at the end of Millennium is a very similar kind of tune. So we've got that hanging over. We've got a little bit of this biblical plague stuff, which Millennium dealt with in itself. So I think it's interesting in that way, and you could see potentially it's maybe a bit too overt for Millennium to do something like this. It's more abstract than that. But what really interests me is the apparition that Scully gets, because Scully in the past has always been able to see these apparitions. I'm thinking of obviously episodes like Beyond the Sea or the episode where she gets the voodoo thing in season 2.
Fresh Bones.
That was going to be the one smart thing I had to say is that Scully.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
You're doing fine.
Well, we can talk about this discussion point. I know it's later in the episode, but the apparition in the car, which obviously then talks about which opens up the question of the fertility, that question, which is where a lot of people will say that's where the fertility.
In the car.
In the car, yeah, because the apparition touches Scully at that point and says, this is not your truth, or whatever he says there. But for me personally, in my head canon, that's where that fertility thing, that inanimate becomes animate, happens, and that's the moment. If you're looking along the tracks. I think that in this episode is where that comes from.
See, the version of the theory I had heard is that it's just the proximity to the ship that restores her fertility, because we see that in this episode, we see the fishes that have come back to life, don't we?
Yeah.
And I think Chris Knowles has talked about that before. And I quite like the theory that.
I like it's definitely come from Chris. It's definitely not me. It's come from that. But on reappraising this, on rewatching it, it just jumped out at me that yes, the proximity of the ship is there, but there's a particular moment where it's directly at Scully. And I think that for me personally, that's in my head, kind of, that's where I can go with it.
Well, that's fascinating. How does that grab you, Sarah? What do you reckon?
I mean, I didn't realize that, but that's kind of cool, I guess. I mean, I still don't understand, like, the vaccine stuff, but okay.
We're stuck on that.
Yeah. Well, because it just, I don't know. So Scully had, because if she gets her fertility restored from the ship, but she's immune to the aliens, but it's fine. Yeah, I think it's a cool theory. I'm going to go with that. I don't know about all of the fertility stuff, really. I don't really like that plot line very much.
Mm. I think the reason a lot of people like that theory is that it minimizes the role that the Smoking Man may have played, isn't it? That's what kind of people think of it.
Yeah, so I can definitely appreciate it.
I like it as a talking point, because the worst thing I say in TV shows that can happen is that it's so overt that it tells you what's going on.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've got NME later on in the season, before what happened in season 11, you know, you've already got some aspect there, and you've got this as a version that you can, I know it's probably a bad word to say, but play with those ideas, and, you know, you can make your own mind up, or you can at least debate it. And, you know, it's perfect for podcasts like this, because you can actually debate the actual question. The fertility thing, I think, because with Mulder being infected by the virus, that's him being infected by the virus, and it's the brain aspect, and it's things in the junk DNA, or whatever you want to call it, being activated. Whereas the fertility is just, it could have been any human person could have been there and could have had that, because it's, they mentions that, what was it, what they called the Eminem, was it, I can't remember what they actually called now.
Eminem. Some shady.
Enemists. The one that believe that everything has got life. So plants, animals, that everything around you is living and sentient and the like, which is really interesting concept. In itself is interesting from that point of view. So, you know, if something can be, re-energize or revitalize because of that, then that's just an interesting concept.
Yeah. Well, so the microchip got rid of her cancer, but she didn't get her fertility back. Is that right?
Yeah, because her ovums were taken, weren't they?
Okay.
Yeah, Mulder was carrying around
in his pocket.
So she just magically got new ova from the spaceship?
Yes.
Okay.
Potentially. Unless you believe another theory on that. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. After the teaser, we have Mulder in the hospital and Skinner talking to the doctor, don't we? This is the thing. So the idea is that Mulder's brain's going to die over time. You know, he's non-responsive at first when Skinner goes in, but then he launches himself at Skinner and he passes him that note, doesn't he? He says, help me, on the bit of cloth, it looked like. So that's kind of what I'm surprised at with you, Sarah, with these episodes, is that we actually get a lot of Skinner, I think, in this one in particular, don't we?
Yes.
And I thought you'd be more into that.
Well, I do like Skinner, and yeah, no, it's fine. I like Skinner, but I think the presence of Skinner is really great, but it's negated by how much Mulder is suffering, and I don't like Mulder suffering. It makes me sad. And I don't like to feel sad feelings.
But I struggle with it, because Skinner in this episode, and it has echoes of Requiem in this as well, where, you know, Skinner's the one that actually pushes Krichkow to go harder, to go find the truth, because Skinner's willing to believe, Krichkow isn't. And for me, it's a really push on Skinner becoming their ally. And we know he's obviously been, you know, he's being held back by Krycek, but the fact that Skinner's willing to believe that he's able to like take that extra step now, that he's willing to go that far, and, you know, and Mulder playing off that with Krycek, which is, we'll talk about that in a little bit later on with the actual scene themselves, which is really interesting to me. So I like it for that. And as I say, I like the echo of that in Requiem. But what I particularly like about this scene is, and I was thinking about Anasazi when I thought about this scene in the hospital, I need to write some of this down, is that the fight ensues. So, you know, bearing in mind that, you know, you have people who are, you know, sort of amped up and, you know, are stronger than what they could be, and Mulder throws Skinner to the wall. And you're thinking, well, Skinner had him in a headlock in Anasazi when he wasn't quite there or whatever, but he was drugged to that point. But then Skinner is physically being choked, right? And Skinner says, "I don't want to hurt you." Yeah. He's actually physically on top of him. And I'm going, yeah, Skinner's just lying there. He could easily get out of this at any moment in time. I just love that. I just love the fact that it was just so underplayed. It's like, "I don't want to hurt you. You're choking me. I'm bleeding, but I'm not going to hurt you," which I thought was incredible.
That's why I love Skinner so much. He loves Mulder. He loves Mulder and Scully so much, and he's willing to like go up against Krycek and the nanobots to help them. But, I mean, he doesn't want to hurt Mulder.
Mm, yeah.
My heart. Sorry, I just needed a second to swoon there.
That's fine. I think the basic pattern we get for this episode is that we go back and forth, don't we, between the hospital and then what's happening in the Ivory Coast. And in the latter storyline, Amina Ngabe turns up, played by Jenelle Kennedy. So she's a professor of biology, like the guy was from Biogenesis. She's heard about Scully's discovery. She, like, I think Scully tells her about the man she saw and the insect swarm and that kind of thing. And she says, Ngabe says that this will be seen as a bad omen by the others. And then they get the boiling water on the beach. So I actually really enjoy seeing the pairing of those two characters, to be honest. And I'd kind of forgotten about it, actually.
Yeah. That was one of the things I liked about this episode.
I suppose in total it's only a few scenes, but yeah, I thought it was good stuff.
Yeah. I like seeing Scully team up with other girls, and like, you know, in Detour, she teams up with
Michelle.
Yeah, thank you. It's fun to watch them try to solve this problem together. And, you know, she comes in and she's like, "There were bugs and all that stuff," but she knows what's up. And so, yeah, I liked that. I liked that they were trying to figure out. And at least, I mean, Scully needs an ally there.
Yeah.
She doesn't know what's going on, or she can't speak the language. She doesn't know anything right now.
Kurt, did you feel the same as me? Like I said, I was kind of surprised how little I remembered about that character.
Yeah.
When we rewatched, I thought it was surprisingly strong stuff, you know?
Yeah, I'd like to have seen more. There's a particular scene where Scully's like lying on the bed and she's next to her. I would like to have seen something more at that point, you know, with not that way, Mr. Sweeney.
Didn't say anything.
You didn't say anything. Luckily, this is a podcast. It's audio and not visual. But yeah, it's, but it would have been nice to have them like talk to each other at that point and, you know, maybe sort of see extra scenes at that, during that moment. I thought it was really interesting, the discussion that she has where she does turn up and she says that it's a secret, but unfortunately it's a well-known secret. I thought that's a nice little meta conversation on the mythology as well, because it's like there is news of this thing happening in Amor Fati. We find, you know, things are being hidden away again. So it's, but it's an interesting, like, open secret rather than being it's a secret cabal. It's just an open secret, which I thought was really interesting. But yeah, the scenes together, I would have liked to have seen more, because they definitely bounce off each other really nicely.
Mm. So, like I say, it goes back and forth to the hospital, and we get this, you know, Skinner goes back to Mulder, and it's the scene we've already alluded to where Mulder writes the K and the R.
It made me think of Lamp, Palm. That's all I was thinking of. Palm.
From Talitha Kumi. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but like Kurt says, I think your instinct as a viewer is to think that must allude to Krycek, but it doesn't. They found another character. It begins with a K and an R, and it's Michael Krichgau.
It's all been planned. It's all been planned, Carl. Everything, minute detail, all in the Bible.
Has it? Like, do you buy this? Do you think it feels a bit pulled out of thin air to go back to Krycek, who we haven't seen or heard from in, what, a couple of years since Redux 2? Does it land for you, Kurt?
It does feel a bit contrived, but what they do with it, as I say, with the Skinner and Krychkov scene works, because you haven't got a Scully there and you need someone who doesn't believe to be able to get that to work. And, you know, there is a story there, which I'd like to know a bit more on Krychkov's kind of fall from grace after Redux. So it would have been nice. So it does feel a bit like, oh, we'll just pick that character up and we'll see that he's not had a good time, because anyone who's around Mulder doesn't generally have a good time afterwards. So, you know, so it was nice to see him. It does feel a little bit contrived, but again, you know, John Finn's a great actor, you know, and I'd love to see him on screen. So, yeah, it was great to see him again.
It does feel fun to see him again. And we do get a justification, which is that Krychkov has seen Mulder's condition in some kind of CIA study he was privy to about remote viewing, don't we?
Which again, you know, only a year ago, Chip Johannesson wrote an episode of Millennium called Exegesis. It was the second episode of season three, which dealt with remote viewing quite significantly. So again, these kind of recycled or rehashed Millennium ideas are starting to come into season seven, which I think is really interesting.
So what you mean with episodes like Orison as well in some ways?
Yeah, well, in itself is a Chip Johannesson episode, yeah. So there's, you know, and obviously the zombie stuff that plagues the season, as Darren Mooney said so often. So
yeah. So I think what Krychkov says later is that basically he's seen people whose brains are working more than their bodies can keep up with, which is what they think is going on with Mulder. And Skinner kind of susses out that Mulder knew about that, and that's why he asked for Krychkov. So Sarah, because that's what I was wondering is, going into this episode, I knew that you really liked Redux, and so you probably liked the Krychkov stuff. So
I do.
How did you feel seeing him here?
I was happy to see Krychkov back. And I, like Kurt said, I agree that it was cool to see him show up, but it was a little bit contrived, you know? But I think it works. It seemed like they brought him, if they were going to bring anybody back for this role and this purpose in the episode, I'm glad that it was him. So yeah, it was good to see him show up again. And I do agree with Kurt what he said about the fall from grace, because it does seem like Mulder just plows through his entire life just destroying himself and others, and you don't really hear from them again. But it was good to see the results of his efforts, I guess, because it's like, hey, Mulder is creating waves. He is doing things with his quest that involve more than just Scully and Skinner. And it's like this ripple effect that's like going through. So to actually get to see that is pretty cool.
And I think you get more of that in The Sixth Extinction too, because I think when you get to the fantasy world stuff, I think Deep Throat appears, and he is kind of like the embodiment of everybody that's been sacrificed for the quest, isn't he? Because he talks about Melissa Scully and Bill Mulder and a few other people who've kind of been collateral damage. So I think that is interesting. What do you reckon, Kurt?
No, I think you're right. I didn't think of it in the Amor Fati stuff, but yeah, it's definitely it's interesting. And the making waves, it would be nice to just to catch up with some people that might have been affected that way. And you know, because we are very, and I think this is an issue with the X-Files as a whole, and I wouldn't change it for the world, so I'm not suggesting this, but, you know, we've often said that the X-Files really, even as someone who loves season eight, is the Mulder and Scully show. You know, you've got the supporting characters, but you haven't got an ensemble. It's not like a Blacklist or, you know, or Blind Spot or whatever kind of procedure you've got, where you've got like, you know, even like Fringe, for example, has got two main characters, but you've got a third in the dad and, you know, the FBI and whatever. So you've got like good four or five characters there. It's always Mulder and Scully. So you're always seeing it from that point of view, and it's difficult to see what other people are doing and where they are. You know, and a lot of the times everything revolves around them. So you think about Krychek, you know, there's always something he's doing, but it always connects to Mulder in some way. So it's, so it's difficult from that perspective to see the collateral damage, because, you know, the show quickly moves on and it's the nature of the storytelling. And, the X-Files was a pioneer in like the mythology stuff, but it's, you know, it struggles because it does have to reset like most 90s TV shows did.
Okay. So back in the Ivory Coast, and we get more Scully voiceover. You know, I feel you slipping away from me every minute I fail here, that, all that stuff. What do you guys make of the Dr. Barnes scenes here? Because I sort of feel like maybe they're the weakest aspect of this episode. You know, when he first turns up, you know, I think Scully says he's the murderer and so on. We get the sea of blood and the vanishing man is seen again by Scully. But yeah, Barnes, I don't know. Sarah, were you, were you captivated by the Dr. Barnes scenes in this episode and by Genesis?
I can't say I totally really understood what was going on with that guy. So please help me understand.
Dr. Barnes in Biogenesis, if memory serves me right, was anti all this.
At face value.
At face value, where he actually was seeking this out to suppress it, I believe. That's my understanding of it. So Krycek draws an allegiance with him. I think the open secret thing obviously gives us the fact that Barnes can get there and he wants to have it. And it's kind of similar to what Krycek wants. It's like, I want the discovery. I'm the one that wants to be able to tell the world this. I'm the one that wants the power. And the very nature of that, which I think is the way that the episode is kind of trying to portray, is that people who are actively trying to get the information from that ship, that kind of monolith ship, all-powerful ship, are being, the ship itself is protecting itself by doing the Red Sea, by trying to show these omens that people might well believe, which it goes back to the whole Scully seeing an apparition thing, because Scully is so used to seeing those aspects that is something that might naturally feel that she's protected from. And because she's not seeking power, she's seeking something completely different.
Yeah.
That's why she's able to do what she does. Whereas Barnes is looking purely at trying to get the information, the power and stuff like that. So, I feel that that's kind of where Barnes is. And he just becomes absolutely, you know, I suppose knowledge is power, but he just becomes completely crazed. Besotted with it and crazed with trying to get this information because it's so close for him. My question would be, and again, it goes back to the whole, the episode doesn't want to do this in the way that old episodes did, is that if you've got someone who we know has murdered somebody, even though he says he didn't, you wouldn't leave a machete on a table or anything that could harm yourself while he's around, would you? That's all that's the main
Probably
thing I
not.
Would say. So.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. That's true. Yeah. Does that explanation satisfy you, Sarah?
It does, and it actually makes me like it a little bit better.
Ooh.
Like, incrementally, you're getting me on board with this episode, so I'm here for it. But
do you think there's a problem, though, when it takes that explanation, if it's not evident,
yes,
from the episode itself?
But also, I'm me, so I feel like other people probably understand this a lot better and are more invested than I am. So.
I think by its nature, it's abstract, isn't it?
That's what I was going to say. I think a lot of it is kind of difficult to come to terms with just off a single viewing, isn't it, Kurt?
Yeah. No, I think it's more in my wheelhouse when you talk of TV shows like Twin Peaks or stuff which are completely and utterly abstract, hardly understandable, and you have to like feel it rather than actually understand it. And this has an element of that. It's like more of a feel. And I know that obviously behind the scenes, I can't remember if we talked about this in Biogenesis, but Chris Carter's kind of, you know, newfound kind of spiritualism is obviously being the major pushing element to this and trying to conjoin the God and alien, ancient alien kind of aspect, which I know that, you know, in future years has become quite prominent in TV shows and even like sort of there's been memes on Twitter and all kinds of ancient aliens, you know, it was aliens. But it, by the very nature of this, these three episodes, they're abstract in nature. So I don't think they're meant to be dissected this way.
Yeah.
And I think even, I've seen the Chris Carter quote, which I may end up, reading out on the Amor Fati episode, which I may have already recorded. But he talks about how those dream sequences are designed to be purposefully ambiguous, you know. So there's an element of it isn't all meant to be understood. I think you're right, Kurt. Sarah just kind of rolled her eyes at that.
It's all in Chris Carter's head, and he expects us all to be on board with that. But I think the biggest reason that I have a hard time with the mythology is because I feel like Chris Carter does this thing where he writes everything and he expects people to be as smart and get things that he doesn't put on the screen. Like, I refer to it as a page because I'm a book author. But, like, there's so much that you need to put on the page to, like, ground it in the story. And so often he doesn't get to that point, if that makes sense. Like, he has all these things in his mind, and you just don't ground it with what's there. And so it's hard to make that leap.
I know what you mean, but I prefer that to, like, kind of like what Kurt was saying earlier, a situation where everything is crystal clear and there's nothing to interpret. And,
well, yes.
I had that very issue with WandaVision, when WandaVision was on. Episode 4 explained what was going on.
Was that the format breaking one that was kind of more of a Marvel piece?
It was back to being a Marvel episode, and it was like, I don't need to know that. I would prefer that to be a bit later on. And to be fair to WandaVision, they actually explained it in a way. There were still other questions that needed to be answered and asked and stuff like that. Same with Lost. You know, there's certain things in Lost where it would go on a different gravy train, and then something else would happen, and you kind of forget about what's happened there. But I think it needs that balance. And sometimes, if you're talking like a Twin Peaks, if you're talking to David Lynch or Chris Carter leans more toward a Lynch mindset than he does for something where he's got to explain stuff. And I'd say with WandaVision, it felt like that, going back to the Marvel thing, was like, oh, it's back to Marvel. They've explained everything. I didn't need to know how it happens. I just need to know it happened. So there's just that balance. And I think people are on different parts of the scale with it. And
well, it is a balance. And you want to show, you don't want to tell. So there's like you don't want to like spoon feed everybody everything, because that's not fun and it's not interesting. But you also don't want to be like so far on the other end of the scale that it's like indecipherable, you know. So
I tell you what was very obviously tell, which my other half was in the room while I was watching the episode, and it was when they were drawing the phonetics with the E, and she was like, oh, because she draws around the symbol and then she points the pencil at the E, and I was like, no, you don't need to do that. That's too much. It's too much direction. But even my other half was like, that's too obvious.
Yeah. Well, Kurt, it's an interesting comparison with WandaVision, but there's no Elizabeth Olsen here, but there is Mimi Rogers. So
there is.
You know, because we get all that stuff where Mulder's, they make him more lucid, don't they? And he says they're coming, and then we cut to Fowley, who's like, he's not in his bed. And then that's funny when Skinner's there, he's like, you know, I found it down the hall. I don't know. We got a couple of interesting moments involving Fowley. And I think there's a good scene later on, which we'll come on to. But I like the moment here where Skinner's like, I'm his boss. And then he like nods at Fowley. He's like, and hers, you know, kind of putting her in a place. You guys happy to see Fowley on the scene?
Mm-mm. I'm always happy to see Skinner put Fowley in her place. Yeah. So there's that.
it's an interesting one, because in Biogenesis, she's kind of not quite understanding where she's going. So she feels like she's got a hold on what's happening now, which I quite like. We'll talk about the scene later on in a bit more detail. But at this point, I think you need that antagonist, and she's definitely playing the antagonist at this point. You know, without actually really giving anything away at the moment, I think it's more, you know, we need someone to go up against them to give them that bit of agency, really. And I think it works effectively enough. The walking down the corridor is always a memorable Fowley walk down the corridor. I always remember that with the nurse. It's like, you know, what's going on, kind of thing. But it's effective in the way it is. And I do like the way Skinner puts Fowley in a place. I thought that was really good. And again, go back to season 6. If we had more Fowley and Spender on the X-Files, it would have had more play with it. It's just the fact that that's the only time we... Yeah,
she, we like, disappeared for an entire season. And then it's like, oh, yeah, she just shows up again. Like, ugh.
Yeah. I agree. I think it would have been nice to incorporate them into more episodes, because there's that clear division, isn't there, between they turn up in mythology episodes only, it seems like.
Yeah.
I mean, Spender, there are a couple of exceptions to that, but Fowley, not really. So there's some stuff about the craft, isn't there? Like, we're going to have a Scully voiceover when they're piecing everything together. This is where they talk about how they found passages from the Bible and pagan religions and that are somehow imbued with power, panels representing human chromosomes, and Gaby says, it's the word of God. So were you struggling to follow this stuff, Sarah? And like, yes, to get on board with it? Yeah.
Is this the episode where the piece like flies into the Bible?
And that's
like
in Biogenesis.
Okay. I liked that part. That was cool. I like the idea of the, okay, what is there, didn't Scully have a special name for it? I feel like there was a special name for it, where it's like people, we come from other planets or whatever, like
the origins. Panspermia.
Panspermia.
That.
In Biogenesis, yeah.
Weird word, but that. So I like that theory and that idea. I think that's a cool thought, that all these planets have existed for so many millions of years, and like somehow it's like, I mean, it's the same thing as like a dandelion. So you've got your dandelion and the things just float away and land and make more dandelions everywhere. So it's kind of like that, which I like that idea. It's interesting to think about. So the idea that all of these religions and things could come from this one spaceship or this one civilization is pretty interesting. And it also kind of goes back to the Ruins book by Kevin Anderson, because they go to Chichen Itza, and or it's a different one, but like Chichen Itza. And it's the aliens, like the ancient Mayans have been worshiping aliens who came in a spaceship and crashed, and they built this temple around it. So it's kind of ties in with that, which I appreciate.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, Kurt, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but so the idea is that, so this ship, which may be some kind of special ship, which it seems quite different to the other UFOs we've seen in other episodes, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it came to Earth way back when. It created life on Earth with alien DNA. And of course, obviously, there's been a lot of evolution since then. But it's possible that, and it seems to be what this scene is kind of referring to, that things like significant religious leaders and ideas and miracles and things like that are all in some way manifestations of this ship. Is that your understanding of it? And my question is, I suppose, as a follow-up, does this make for interesting drama in the sense that it is all quite a bit abstract, isn't it? And like, why should we care where life came from, you know, as long as we're here, you know, it's all good.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because I think the one bit we're missing with this, I'll come on to the stuff on the ship in a minute, but the one thing that we're missing is that this doesn't necessarily mean that the aliens that we've had in the past are any different. You know, this could be a different species. This ship could actually be something completely and utterly alien to them as well. That it just happens that this panspermia kind of idea that, you know, that this kind of monolith has appeared in multiple variations, you know, and around the universe or whatever, and it's created life wherever it's been. So it's not necessarily like the aliens that we've been dealing with before. Is interesting. I like that. I don't like the whole, the writings of the Quran are on it, or the writings of the Book of Genesis. I didn't mention that, but stuff like the Book of Genesis is on there. How to create chromosomes is the map of life, because that in itself, it's been too explanatory, and it's like, it's not feasible talking about not being grounded. That doesn't ground it to me. Whereas if it was this, you know, this something just so alien to us that, you know, this could potentially be seen as a thing from God or whatever because of what it can produce or can do, then that would be different. I just think that the explanation just really kind of sends it off in a direction I don't particularly like about it, because it just feels like it's too convoluted. It's too exposition heavy for that. You know, the fact that all languages are on there and stuff, it doesn't really transcend for me in that way. So I think it's interesting as well that I've been watching some documentaries recently about the, you know, the beginnings of life and things. And I'm not a scientist and I'm paraphrasing what was said, but apparently that one cell had invaded another, but managed to survive in the cell itself. So it was one cell with two things in there. And that's what created life. And we don't think, obviously at the moment, there's no evidence to say that's happened anywhere else in the universe kind of thing. So the fact it is that, like it was said in biogenesis, you've got that spark, that one thing that doesn't happen anywhere else in the universe to create life. If that monolith, that UFO was to create that, then I can be on board with that. But as I say, I think having the Quran, having religious texts on there, having scientific knowledge is just a way of telling the audience where they want to go with it, which is basically Scully as a scientist finally saying the word, I think it's extraterrestrial. That's kind of what it's coming down to.
Yeah. But also that's not how languages work. I study language because that's my job. So the history of language is that it starts from this thing and then it evolves and changes. So the fact that, you know, you can have, and yes, the Quran is an ancient book, but it's not that ancient. And the fact that you would have all of these different languages that they could read at this point, like it's not a Rosetta Stone. I mean, they want it to be the Rosetta Stone, but it's not. And so, like, you can't just have something that's supposed to be billions of years old and, like, spawn. Because where would those passages come? It just, none of it makes sense. From, like, as far as language evolution goes, none of it makes sense. You're not just going to, like, capture all these languages at one particular time and slap them on a alien ship, because you would have to get there to begin with. That makes sense.
It's almost as if people were affected by being in the vicinity of the ship and having, like, I don't know, visions or something while you're in there, mm-hmm. would be a better way of doing it than the way they did it.
Yeah.
But I understand the reason why they did it that way, But
yeah.
It would have been better to have more of a visceral, visual representation of things and seeing stuff. Like you would maybe get in Millennium, for example, in Frank Black's visions, when he does get all these visions in his head for, you know, either an apocalypse coming or serial killer murderer. If you had some sort of vision kind of quest on that, then that would explain more than it would do for having something written on a ship.
And it would have made Mulder's plight make more sense too, if there were other people who were affected.
Let's talk about Mulder, because there's quite a fun scene, isn't there, when they do the remote viewing test with him in the hospital. He actually makes the "who you gonna call" joke, because it kind of recalls that scene in Ghostbusters. But they do the test slowly, don't they, when he's pressing the things, and he's not very accurate. It's like 5% accuracy, they say. And then it's quite fun when Skinner says, "do it again faster," and then Mulder's hand's just like going, you know, doing it really quickly.
It's literally just going like doing that.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was nice. I thought it was a fun scene.
I like that Skinner saw, because you can tell when he's doing it slow, like he touches it and then you can see it show up after he touches it. So you know that he's predicting it. So I appreciate that Skinner is the one who pointed that out and noticed it. Mm. I like that.
I wanted to talk about, quite a lot goes on in the Ivory Coast stuff, but particularly when they're driving to the police. I like that, you know, they see she sees the man in the road. And, like, then Scully sees the man in Ngabi's place. You know, I think he says, "some truths are not for you." In the moment, Kurt's talking about where he touches her head, but then Ngabi reappears. And Scully's really kind of spooked by it, isn't she? She's kind of, you know, it is quite an eerie scene. And it seems like that's what drives her to decide she's going home.
Yeah, I thought it was really nice. I think, as I say, going back to, you know, Fresh Bones and the apparition stuff and, you know, it's not something that she hasn't seen before,
but it's not something you'd normally see in a mythology kind of installment, really, is it? That's what's interesting about it.
Yeah, but as I say, to have the reaction that she has, you know, she's not like terrified, but she's, you know, almost like acceptance of this is a higher power. This is something I can't get involved in this kind of thing. And I like that. I like the fact that she decides to make that choice to. you know, this needs to be left alone now. I need to get back. This is too much. And the very physical thing she's investigating is telling her that, you know, this isn't some truth and this is not for you. You don't need to know this kind of thing. So she accepts that and moves on.
So back at the hospital, so there's the whole thing where they're going to try and get Mulder out, but it's kind of foiled, isn't it, by Fowley.
I've just seen a note just before we go on, just that another great line in that UFO scene, right, is when Critchgirl goes, yeah, most people are at 5%, and Skinner turns out and goes, I'm assuming that's low. Yeah. It's like, yeah, 5% is quite low.
It's not that great.
Sorry, yeah. I just seen it on my notes, that's why I had to mention that.
Yeah. No, I was gonna bring up the scene with Fowley talking to Mulder, you know, because I actually thought this is quite pivotal stuff for her character. As we've said before, Kurt, I don't think she gets like fleshed out that much, but this is a curious scene. So she says that she knows Mulder knows about her. That her loyalties are to someone else, not just to Mulder. So she's talking about the Smoking Man, obviously. Mm. But she says she has her reasons. And she says, Fox, I love you. I've loved you for so long, and I won't let you die to prove what you are. Now we can be together. So this fascinates me, because she has no reason to be inauthentic here, does she? There's no reason to believe she isn't telling the truth, I don't think.
No. No, well, Mulder would know that. And I think what's telling for me on this is that she's not willing to let go, that realize that Mulder actually moved on. And because there's the kind of micro expressions that Mulder gives is like, okay, this is something I wasn't that aware of. And it provides that character thing of like, she was playing the long game. She wants to be able to do what she needs to do to protect him. But, and this is the part of her story arc, I think, is really effective. I think it was really good. I'll still go back to the fact that it wasn't written well. And, you know, and it could have been so much better, but there is that. It's like, it's unrequited love in her, from her perspective, because it's like, she does love him. She left him. She went to Berlin. She got involved with the cigarette smoking man because she wanted to get to the truth, but she was willing to do something that Mulder wasn't. And when it comes round to it and she finally accepts that and gets to this point, that Mulder's quest has completely changed and it's in a completely different direction now. So she's saying that for herself more than anything else. And, you know, you can talk about how right or wrong she was, which, you know, she was probably wrong to do that, you know, to what she's done over the past, you know, 20 years or whatever it was. But, there was the reasons there, and that reason is what I like about her character, and I just think it was done really kind of badly in that way. But and you know, we're talking about the previous episode, for example, just like why have you done that?
Yeah,
which doesn't make any sense. Where this makes sense, and you know, you can have that unrequited love. You can have that Fowley still loves him, but you know, he's obviously clearly. In a different place to where he was back in, you know, the early 90s.
Do you feel, Sarah, like it sets things up well enough? Because, like, in the following episode, she's ultimately going to effectively sacrifice herself for Mulder.
Yeah.
She doesn't like what's going on with the experiment and procedure. Do you think this kind of anticipates that quite nicely?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to Mulder's ripple effect, too, because it's like he's gone through his life. He just plowed through and, like, infected everybody with his passion for this quest or whatever and just deserted them, or not deserted them, but just he's not paying attention to his own fallout, if that makes sense. And so, like, he's gone and made Fowley fall in love with him and just, you know, left it at that. Because yes, she did go to Berlin and leave him, like Kurt said, but you know, he never thought about the consequences of any of their work together. Because then, you know, when she comes back, Scully's like, wait, what? This whole thing just, you had this whole life before me. And, you know, it just comes out of nowhere. And we know the reason why. But in the context of the show, it's just, we could have used that backstory. So, yeah, but
yeah,
I don't know. And I do like the idea. Okay, I don't hate the idea of him and Fowley having this relationship or whatever, like this previous relationship. I just don't like that they never fleshed it out a little bit more, because she just shows up in just those few episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not grounded at all. The whole story of Fowley is not grounded, and I wish it were, because it's pretty juicy. It's juicy stuff. It's intriguing. And it would feed a lot into Mulder's backstory and his quest and, you know, why he's doing what he's doing.
I think we don't ever get
that chance to see that.
It's something I've not really thought of in the grander aspect of the people that Mulder's left along the line. So, you know, it's a microcosm for Critchkow, but for Fowley, you're talking years and years and years of, you know, of effectively, in inverted commas, being undercover or doing what she thinks she needs to do. I know that Monica Reyes kind of like is the pseudo Fowley in some ways in later seasons for that. But it's the same kind of concept of like, she's willing to do what she needs to do to get to the truth. And she's basically saying to Mulder now, you've done enough. You've proved it. Why do you need to go any further? Pretty much what Scully said as well at the end of Biogenesis, you know, just saying, you know, what is there to do? You know, so it's the same concept, but the very fact that Mulder's left her behind because of that is intriguing to me. And I've never thought about it in that way, which is itself is an interesting concept.
The thing I had never thought about until I watched the episode again recently is that there seems like kind of a parallel to me in the sense that here you get Fowley kissing Mulder's head and she's given this kind of expression of love effectively. And then at the end of The Sixth Extinction 2, you get the lovely exchange in the doorway between Mulder and Scully, which also has a forehead kiss. So I don't know if that's an intentional kind of rhyme between the episodes, but I just never noticed that before.
I think that Chris Carter just doesn't like to see people kissing on the lips. He's like, let's just, you know, you're not allowed to kiss on the mouth, guys. Just have to kiss everywhere else. Sorry.
Chris Carter's getting it in the neck in this episode, isn't he?
Yeah.
What about, so Scully gets back to America, back to Washington.
22 hours on a plane.
Yeah, she's done a lot of flying over the course of this in Biogenesis, isn't she, actually? They talk about that in Biogenesis, don't they? How many planes she's taken and that kind of thing. She goes to see Skinner, first of all.
Do you think that's purely because it's like, look, Scully does go venturing as well. It's like Mulder does all the venturing. Let's reemphasize the fact that Scully goes everywhere. She's crossed the globe.
I mean, so there's a couple of interesting scenes with her, though, isn't there, when she's back? So first of all, with Skinner, where Skinner's like, well, there's nothing to be done about it. But then she does go to see Mulder. And she talks quite obliquely about what she found. But it's nice that she's talking to him. She gets very emotional, doesn't she? She tears up. She holds his hand. And she tells him to hold on. I thought that was a good scene, that one, that last one in particular.
I liked how Fowley, when she talks to Mulder, she makes it about herself. Like, I have loved you. But Scully makes it about him. You know? Like, I need you to... You know, I don't remember exactly what she said, but essentially Scully is considering Mulder and using her empathy and putting herself in his place, whereas Fowley is making it all about her, which is one of the reasons I don't like her very much.
Well, and Scully also, I think she uses the phrase at one point, the pieces of air for us to put together. So like kind of like a collective thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I took that line itself. I actually took that as, you know, this is the beginning of a new mythology. You know, that we've found something here. This is a new beginning or a new chapter of, you know, Mulder and Scully putting the pieces together to finally find an answer before the end of the show. But obviously,
and then it kind of goes in other directions.
Not on the X-Files. No. How dare we have answers on the X-Files?
In some ways, though, is that a good thing? Because some of the aspects in this trilogy that we're saying, maybe they're reaching a bit with, you know, the idea of the biblical prophecies and, you know, the passages from the Quran on the ship and all that. Because those ideas largely stay to one side now, don't they, going forward, until season 9, in the two-parter in season 9. But if they had really pursued this as a new path, we might have ended up with more of that kind of thing we don't really like. Do you know what I mean? Mm.
Yeah.
And maybe it's better off quite self-contained in this trilogy.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like so many times Chris Carter was just said the phrase, wouldn't it be cool if, and then fill in the blank. And then he does that thing, and then it's not so cool. And so he's like, well, wouldn't it be cool if we did this other thing? And then he just goes with that. He's just like doing whatever is the cool thing that comes to his mind. He doesn't stick with what he's already done. And yeah.
I think my problem with that, Sarah, is I think you're attributing too much agency to Chris Carter in a way, but I think the X-Files was shaped. I think the X-Files is shaped by so many of the factors about, you know, is the network going to pick us up for another season?
Right.
If the network does pick us up for another season, are the actors still going to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think some of the storytelling is obviously kind of impacted by that, you know?
And he's not the only one who came up with storylines. You know, I mean, or David Duchovny came up with a lot of the storylines, especially in, you know, season 4 and all that. But like,
of course, there was meant to be a Krychek episode in season 7 as well.
Yeah. It's not, I'm not putting it all on Chris Carter, definitely. That's a good point. It's just, I mean, he is the showrunner and creator. It all has to come from his head. He's the alien spaceship origin. Yeah.
I look at it differently in this and Requiem, where Biogenesis last season, this and Requiem, where it feels like it's like the rebuilding project. The theme is about rebuilding, and it's just finding what that means. And they're just trying to find that thing. Now, obviously, previous mythologies have had the pregnancy, which forced things that way. And they've kind of gone, right, well, we'll use the Cold War as a running line through season 3. You know, use the cancer in season 4. You know, so they're just trying to latch onto something that will stick, and because it's an abstract idea, it's a difficult one to actually kind of make stick because it is so abstract. I had another point as well. Oh yes, so talking about Scully. So what I find really interesting is her starting to talk about the extraterrestrial stuff as well. You know, the fact that she does say it very much could be extraterrestrial in nature. And another Skinner thing for me, which I really really enjoyed in the scene before the hold on scenes, was that Skinner was so willing to believe with everything that he did, and he got burnt by doing that because he thinks he's gone too far. And it's something that Mulder and Critchcar mentioned it with Mulder saying again, going that how far would Mulder go, which is something that, you know, Doggett will say next season. It's like how far are people willing to go to actually get to the truth, which is interesting because Skinner thinks he's there, he's going to go so far, and, you know, spoiler alert, by the end of the season, loses Mulder. And in this one, he thinks he's just about to lose Mulder. So when Skinner starts to believe, he has consequences.
Mm-hmm. Might come back to that because Chandru's left us a message in the mailbag, which refers to some of that. But in terms of what you're saying about, you know, it being abstract and that makes it hard to land certain things, I think you were saying. I mean, you sort of see some of that with the Ivory Coast scenes towards the end of this episode, don't you? Because first of all, you get Dr. Barnes being hacked down by the undead man who's come back to life or whatever. But then the episode ends at the Ivory Coast with Ngebe and the police going to Barnes' body, doesn't it? And that final shot is of the camera pulling away from her as she looks out to sea, the spaceship is gone and all that. So it's kind of curious as a cliffhanger, isn't it? Or not, it doesn't even feel like a cliffhanger in some ways. It just feels like the end of the episode. It doesn't have the punch of some of the to-be-continued moments we've seen elsewhere on the series. And I actually quite like that. I sort of feel it fits this trilogy fairly well.
I think it fits it quite well. It's an interesting thing. For Dr. Barnes himself, again, going back to the Scully scene apparitions, that he seems to be obsessed with the life returning back.
Yeah.
He seems to be obsessed with it, and that's what actually kills him.
Doesn't mean, yeah.
Yeah, so it's for me, it's almost like the whatever they believe, or, you know, like the people in the sea, that they kind of believe that it comes true because that's the fear that they fear the most, and the spacecraft is reacting to that. So I find that really fascinating that's how Dr. Barnes finishes, by being killed by a zombie.
Hoist by his own petard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I just wanted to touch on while on my notes, I didn't quite get a chance to touch on it with Scully. Is we're talking about the difference between Fowley kissing and Scully kissing the thing. And what I find really interesting throughout the whole entire episode, and I've got this down as a three-part thing. So in Biogenesis, we get the dissonance. We get all of the kind of like he can't hear things, but he knows something's happening to him. In this one, we don't get anything at all from Mulder, really. We just know that he's hearing things. You see it on the ECG and stuff like that. And, you know, Skinner gets told, I know your thing on Krycek. So we get it kind of told to us via Mulder. But the minute that Scully comes in, the dissonance starts to come back. And I thought that's a really interesting point to make, that the moment that Scully comes back, the one in 5 billion, that we start to hear that dissonance again, that we can hear Scully, he can hear Scully, we can hear it as an audience member, which I think is really interesting.
I liked the way that was done, actually, how you go from him hearing the voices to it becoming Scully's voice, and she comes in and she says, Mulder, it's me. I thought it was done quite nicely, yeah. Sarah, any final thoughts on this episode?
You know, I feel really bad that I watched the wrong one, because I was not paying very close attention to this one, because I was just like, well, I just need to get through it so that I can get to the one that I do have to pay attention to. So I wasn't, it's like, what a way to start off this season.
So when on the episodes you recorded already, you were meant to record those episodes, weren't you? Just wanted to check.
Goldberg Variation is just the one, so I'm pretty sure that was correct, hopefully.
It wasn't down for Carl and myself to do it, was it?
It's not like it was. Yeah, it.
Wasn't the Find the Future Minute, wasn't it, Kurt? And I can't remember.
Somebody recorded me. That was me and Darren and Russ and Katie Doe, I think it was.
Yeah.
I almost told Annie that she was going to be on a me instead of All Things. And she's like, are you sure you want me to do that one? That's kind of a big episode. And I was like, yeah, definitely. You got this. And then Carl was like, but she's on All Things. And I was like, oh, right. Never mind. You're on All Things. She's like, oh, good. Because I like that one. It's like, okay. Okay, so final thoughts. I think you guys have convinced me to like this episode incrementally more.
Appreciate it.
Yes, there are definitely more aspects now that I can appreciate about this episode. I still don't like the episode, but I feel like I understand it a little bit better. So thank you for helping me understand it.
It's okay. That's what we're here for. I'm not going to do a full mailbag section today because I asked for people to respond about the whole trilogy, so I'll read all them out with Tony on Amorfati. However, Chandru Ravindran left us a message, and I think he didn't read my original message properly. He left us a long comment on the Sixth Extinction, so I think it's only fair to him to read that out. So, like I said, it's fairly long, but it's good stuff as ever from Chandru. He says, this episode is superficially enjoyable. I really enjoy the direction that this episode and Biogenesis take the mythology, but they ruin it by, of course, having the craft vanish at the end of the episode. I love the music, especially the use of the Plague track from Fight the Future. Watching Skinner desperately trying to help Mulder is pretty riveting, and it's generally well made. And the mysticism angle is generally very creepy in a way the mythology rarely gets to be, I think. But wow, the writing. I think the underlying story is good, but the delivery of said story leads to one of the most poorly written episodes I can think of that is not an outright bad episode. So much of it feels unnatural or melodramatic in a way that screams, this is for the trailer. Here are some examples. So some of these we might have talked about, some we haven't, I don't think. So number one, Mulder determining that Michael Krichgau is the only one who can help him. What? Where did this come from? Even though I enjoyed him returning, this felt like it was completely pulled from Mulder's ass. I mean, we talked a bit about this one already, guys, but in a word, like fair or unfair criticism?
Fair, because I had that thought and I didn't say it on the podcast, but it's like, where did that come from? Why does he think that? And has he been in touch with Krichgau, since that happened? You know, it feels like it's completely left field, yeah.
I agree. Totally out of Mulder's ass.
Point two. The whole, it has power, it is power exchange. It all sounds fine and dandy in that super flowery Chris Carter way, and it was used heavily in the promo material for this episode. But the conversation doesn't actually go anywhere other than in circles, and it's brought down by the fact that Scully and Dr. Ngebe let Barnes get the drop on them. Which I think kind of is what you were saying, Kurt, with them leaving the machete out, isn't it? So fair or unfair? Fair?
Fair.
Fair. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Always put the machete on the table when you're going to use it later, by the way.
Yeah.
And Scully with machete is all right. That's a power move there.
That's from Chekhov.
What's I was going to say, Chekhov's machete. When you use machete in Act 1, it's going to be used by the end. Right. Point three. So Kritschgau was brought unwillingly into the fold by Skinner, who is adamant that he helped Mulder, so Kritschgau grudgingly agrees. Then within about 20 minutes, Skinner is suddenly very hesitant about doing anything, and Kritschgau is completely gung-ho. It all leads to another made-for-the-trailer moment where Kritschgau yells, "Well, how far should it go? How far would Mulder go?" But that dialogue is so melodramatic because the characterizations are all over the place here. Fair or unfair?
I'm heading towards unfair on that one. Yeah. A little bit. I get what he's saying, but Skinner's in a world where he's not used to, and he's wanting to believe, he's just struggling to it, and I think it's an eternal struggle more for Skinner. So I get it, and I don't think that Kritschgau's really going, "How far would Mulder go?" You know, it's like, "How far would he go? How far would Mulder go?" I would a bit more nuanced.
I'm a bit more lenient on that one too.
Yeah.
Do you think that Skinner doesn't believe, though? Because I feel like it's pretty established that he does believe, and that the whole purpose of him trying to, like...
It's not so much him not believing, it's him having faith in his own opinion that he believes. It's he's having an inner struggle he believes it, he's just not there as, like, he's not completely 100% committed to it because he's still a bit apprehensive about it.
He believes in the supernatural, but not aliens yet, so... Right.
Well, no, I think from the very thing of, like, you're not thinking hard, and with Kritschgau, going back to that scene where where Mulder's pointing at Kritschgau saying you're not willing to go that far, you're not willing to believe, and Skinner is willing to believe. Kritschgau's never believed it was UFOs. He's always thought it's a UFO propaganda.
Yeah.
Where Skinner's willing to believe it, but to be able to physically say it, and we get that a lot in season 8, don't we, Skinner? Where he knows what he saw, he keeps saying, "I know what I saw," but he's just not, he's apprehensive about actually physically saying it.
Verbalizing it. Yeah.
Gotcha. All right.
So Chandru's final point is the final conversation where Scully asks Mulder to hold on. It feels like a conversation that's trying to replicate the magic of some of their major moments from episodes like Memento Mori, Redux 2, and Patient X, but it feels half-baked. It's like she latches on to hold on as her mantra for the entire conversation because the writers needed a hook, and she just keeps repeating it. It ends up really cheesy. Don't get me wrong, it's phenomenally acted, just not well written. So I'm going to say unfair on that, because I actually like that scene quite a bit.
I think on first watch, I would have said unfair. I think the more I see it, the more I'm kind of immune to its draw. So I think it is...
Partially fair?
Partially fair, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unfair.
Oh, interesting. Sarah, I wanted to give you a chance to vent and to make use of your notes on the Sick Extinction 2 before we go. I'm going to be back with Tony talking about that soon, but you said that's the one you'd liked the least. What is it about that one that really got under your skin?
Okay, first of all, I don't care for when they use dreams as, like, a plot device. So, like, you have this whole thing, and it's, like, all in Mulder's head, and... it's like, this isn't really happening. And that annoys me. Okay, so one of the things, this is just a random thing from my notes because it's the biggest written. When they're doing, like, the brain transplant or whatever, like, what even is that? And the guy's like, and he's like, "Are we ready?"
Gland.
Hmm? To what?
Hiya. The pituitary gland is where the black oil kind of, like, goes around.
Isn't that the pineal gland?
The pineal gland. That's the word. they're taking that out because that's the aspect of him, of Mulder's new found powers, and they're implanting it into Cigarette Smoking Man.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
That's where they're finding that DNA. So he's trying to, because he's his dad... because they kind of forced the idea that he's his dad at that point, because it's always been alluded to, that he's going to take over, the Smoker Man's going to take his quest over and deal with it himself.
So I wrote, this episode is so fucked in, like, big giant letters. because, oh, for Pete's sake. I don't know.
You want, like, the Twin Peaks return, then?
Yeah, I don't know. I wrote, like, a whole bunch of notes on this. But I like that Krichgau is back. I like the one part where Skinner tells, he literally tells Scully, I am in a compromised position. He's talking about Krychek, right? He's like, I can't do this because I am in a compromised position. And she still doesn't get it. She's still just like, what? And I'm like, Scully, he literally just told you. He just told you he can't do this because he's compromised. Like, listen to him. He says everything so plainly and they just don't listen. Drives me nuts.
Will you do me a favor, Sarah? Will you listen to mine and Tony's discussion of Amor Fati, and will you see if it changes your mind at all?
Yes. And also, what's that one part where he's dreaming? I know it's a dream, but then Cigarette Smoking Man just like opens the window and like everything is on fire. The whole world is like being destroyed and on fire. And it's just like, oh my God. Like, I was just done. I was just done.
Yeah, great moment.
Really good moment.
Yeah, really, really, really good moment. One of the best of the show's run.
All right, well, I'm glad at least, Sarah, you had that chance to get it off your chest anyway.
Sorry.
When are we going to hear you guys again? I'm on the Amor Fati main episode. Kurt, you'll be back soon after that.
I'm doing a bonus episode on the Temptation, Last Temptation of Mulder. Is what we're calling it. So I'm not quite finished with this trilogy just yet, but you'll see me on the main show on Millennium, I think is the next one, or Rush. I think
Millennium
first, and then Rush are the next two that you will hear me on.
So Sarah, you said the Goldberg variation. So is that the next one?
That's the next one I'm hosting, but I think I'm coming back before that with you guys, right? No. Am I?
First I've heard about it.
Okay.
I think we're back, aren't we? Is it the Amazing Melini we're doing together?
Yes. Okay. So, yep. No, I'm back with Cortland. Yep. Cortland and I are doing Goldberg Variation. So that's going to be fun. Definitely look out for that one. Cortland had some amazing things to say. So I'm really excited for you to hear her thoughts.
Excited to hear it.
So as I say, we recorded the Millennium one with Darren. And that was a really interesting one because it is a crossover and we have another podcast about Millennium. It's an interesting one because it's obviously we're looking at it from two different viewpoints. Mm. So it was, it's an interesting one to talk about. And when people, I think Katie Doe had said something like, if Millennium's all about zombies, and me and Darren are both going, it's not about zombies. Millennium is about zombies.
Like, you know, if that's the only thing you've ever seen.
Yeah, if that's the only thing you've ever seen, you might think so. So that's when you'll next see me on Millennium.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Looking forward to the bonus episode you're doing as well on the Sixth Extinction 2. That's going to be very fun. All right, let's just do quickly social media stuff then. I'm CKJ, at CKJ Sweeney on Twitter. The podcast is at the X underscore cast, and you can find us on Facebook as well with the Basement Group and Instagram as well. Sarah, where are you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Sarah L. Blair and on Instagram at author.sarah.blair. And yeah, there you go.
Very good. And Mr. North?
Find me on Twitter at R. Muldrake, R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. And you can also find me on the Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast. And you can find that at Red Dwarf Pod. And then hopefully, as the back end of the year comes, we should be getting some more news on Star Trek Picard. So you can find me on the Star Trek Picard podcast, Make It So, which is found at Jean-Luc Poddard. So those are the best places to find me.
Great stuff. And I just realized that this is probably the last time we'll ever talk about Diana Fowley together on the podcast because...
Yeah, I get to talk about her in The Temptation of Mulder, so yeah. I'm not quite finished with her yet.
Well, I hope you can keep it all together, because obviously she gets bumped off in that episode, so it's going to be an emotional time.
There's a scene involving handcuffs, so we'll see.
That's compensation, yeah. All right, so that's all, everybody, for this episode of the X-Cast. Until next time, always remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Movie Palace.
Yeah, I can remember my first viewing of The Sound of Music
quite distinctly, actually, because it was 8 days ago.
You've never seen it before that?
8 days ago was the first time I'd sat down to watch it from start to finish. Now, I always associate Big Sound of Music. It's interesting that you both talk about it as an Easter thing. It is associated with bank holidays here, but I don't think it's just Easter. So I had seen a lot of these sequences. I think if I was inside on a bank holiday when I was a child and The Sound of Music was on, it was normally a bad thing because it meant it was raining and I couldn't go out and play football.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
I've got 5 tattoos. So I started getting tattoos when I was about 5 years ago, and it was just sort of one by one, I guess. So not huge coverage, but I'm definitely... got the bug, so to speak. So but the latest one is the Red Dwarf one. Yeah,
and that's the one you've decided to talk about today. Describe it for me.
Yeah.
Free with this month's issue.
Obviously, you must remember the sign in musical exchanges.
I do indeed.
Do not play. Yeah, there was a few riffs, weren't there, that you weren't allowed to. This being top of them.
Enter Sandman, Smoke on the Water, Stairway to Heaven, anything widdly above the 12th fret, I think that song said.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that paid no attention to that shit. Remember when we almost got thrown out for playing with that delay pedal?
Yes.
It was amazing.
I also remember the day that I went in with my birthday money to Musical Exchanges to buy a pedal, and I ended up buying the Boss Hyper Metal, and I was insisting to the bloke that I was buying it from. I was like, I don't really play much metal. I just like the sound of it. I want to use it for sort of, you know, more experimental sounds. It's like you're wearing a Metallica t-shirt.
I'm not that into metal, actually. I want to do something more like Swans with it, like My Bloody Valentine, that kind of thing.
Which I did, but I was wearing a Metallica t-shirt at the time.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.